So after the service, if you'd like to see what's happening in the sanctuary, it's open. You're welcome to go in there. There's a lot of, most of the sheetrock's been done. Don't let your kids run around in there by themselves. It's still a construction zone, but feel free to go in there and look around. I saw the best bumper sticker ever. Wednesday night I was going home, it was about 7 o'clock, and there's an old pickup truck, and it had a single word on it. It was others. And I was driving down the road, and I was thinking about what had happened that day, what was going to happen tomorrow. I was thinking about my thinking. I was thinking about me. And all of a sudden, there's a bumper sticker that says, others. And I'm like, yeah, there actually are other people around here, aren't there? And what a surprise. And if Paul the Apostle had a pickup truck, and if he had a bumper sticker on it, I think he might have had this one. You say, no, he would have had a cross or the ichthu fish. I don't think so. I think others. If hearts had bumper stickers on them, apart from the gospel, everybody's heart would have the bumper sticker, me, on it. And the surest sign that Jesus has taken the wheel of a life is this distinct movement towards love for others, not self. And so the heart where Jesus has moved in has this bumper sticker, others, on it. All year we focused on these three things: what we believe, truth that we allow in our heads, values, what shapes our heart, leading to behaviors that move out into our hands, our life. And it's a simple but not a simplistic construct. It really describes how Paul kind of outlines his letters. Simplistic is something so simple it's not accurate. This is simple, but it is accurate. What we believe is true shapes what we wrap our hearts around, what we're learning to love, then determines what we do with our lives. And so we find in the New Testament truth from God, outside in, shaping our hearts, and our hearts shaping our lives inside out. And it's the Spirit of God that empowers us at every level as we stay plugged into relationship with Him. So today we're finishing the book of Ephesians with the gospel applied to some key relationships. And then Paul's going to end this chapter and this book with a sort of reveille, a final wake-up call. And it's important as we look at this chapter to not lose the forest for the trees. And the trees are husband, wife, parent, child, master-slave relationships. The forest is the gospel shaping all the relationships of our lives. The forest of the big picture could be summed up back in chapter 4, verse 1, where Paul wrote, "As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you receive. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love." Or more concisely, in 5:21, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And so Paul's built this gospel house from the ground up, and he doesn't just sort of try to hang the second floor in midair. And so we can't try that either. So we have to read this section in its overall context. So for instance, when he says, "Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord," it's understood in light of all that's come before. And what he says in these applications of the gospel to three different relationships in the first century was revolutionary. And in all three relationships, he ties behavior, interpersonal behavior, back to the gospel. And there's a call in all these relationships to put the interests of others ahead of your own. So I highly recommend Rebecca McLaughlin's book, Confronting Christianity. The whole book is excellent, but her chapters, "Doesn't Christianity Denigrate Women?" and "Doesn't the Bible Condone Slavery?" are especially pertinent to this part of Paul's letter. And again, we're not getting into the weeds on these three examples because we're going to stay with the macro point of Paul's letter, which is the gospel truth, the gospel power, shaping every aspect of our lives. We're going to address the topic of slavery more fully once we get to Paul's letter to Philemon, which will be next June. It's a single chapter letter addressed to a slave owner named Philemon regarding his runaway slave named Onesimus. So these three examples are given to demonstrate that the gospel is real world, that it's not hypothetical, its application, its power is real. So in 22, verse 22 to 32, he describes how the gospel works in that most basic of human relationships, marriage. And he summarizes marriage with, "Wives submit, husbands love, marriage is a picture of the gospel." And wives are called to submit three times in the New Testament, husbands are called to love and honor four times. And McLaughlin wrote that she struggled with this passage until she focused on what Paul was telling the men, which was love as Christ loved the church. And so she writes, "Indeed, when I trained my lens on the command to husbands, the Ephesians passage started to come into focus. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. How did Christ love the church? By dying on the cross, by giving himself naked and bleeding to suffer for her, by putting her needs above his own, by sacrificing everything for her. And I asked myself, how would I feel if this were the command of wives? Wives, love your husbands to the point of death, putting his needs above your own, sacrificing yourself for him. Ephesians 5:22, which is wives, submit to your husbands, is sometimes critiqued as a mandate for spousal abuse. And tragically, it has been misused that way. But the command to husbands makes that reading impossible. How much more easily could an abuser twist a verse calling his wife to suffer for him, to give herself up for him, to die for him? So clearly the call in all of these relationships is to put each other first. And in verse 31, he says, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. And so marriage, imperfectly but ideally, points to a much greater reality than itself, our relationship with God. And McLaughlin points out that this takes the pressure off both single people and married couples. Romantic and sexual love are presented as the highest goods in our culture. If you miss out on sex and romance, you're missing out on life. And Paul says, nope. In the life to come, there is no marriage. It'll have given way to something much greater. And in some religions, the life to come is mostly about sex, physical pleasure, which reveals a lot about that religion. For many Americans, it's inconceivable to think of heaven without sex, which reveals a lot about many Americans. And if you're single, you're not cheated, now or in eternity. Romantic love is a good gift from God, but it is not a greater gift than the gospel, and not by a long shot. And this also takes the pressure off married couples as well. McLaughlin writes again, we don't need to worry about whether we married the right person or why our marriages are not flinging us into a constant state of nirvana, because in one sense, human marriage is designed to disappoint. It leaves us longing for more, and that longing points us to the ultimate reality of which the best marriage is a scale model. Ephesians 5 used to repulse me. Now it convicts me and calls me to Jesus, the true husband who satisfied my needs, the one man who truly deserves my submission. So no one will feel empty, cheated, or unfulfilled, regardless of what does or doesn't happen in this life, not when experiencing the fullness of the life to come. In verses 1 to 4, he briefly addresses the parent-child relationship. Children will thrive when they live in line with God's will and ways. Parents are responsible to make the gospel appealing to their children and give their children the best shot at this thriving life with God. So we read that and go, okay, Paul, great. Give me some details here. Now, what do I do this Friday night when my team wants to do blank? What does this mean when my parents are saying this and doing this? There are a bunch of details to be figured out in all this, aren't there? He's setting the foundation for how to make those decisions. Christy and I struggled, we prayed, we agonized over parenting, we made a bunch of mistakes. She fewer than I did. It was hard, mentally, physically hard, but none of this is a to-do list, a paint-by-the-numbers approach to life and relationships. This is about, here's what's true, here's what's valuable, and here's how you're to focus on who you're becoming and how you live that life. So what's true? Where's my heart? How do I live? And so instead of a checklist, which is what we want, we get, here's how you employ God's resources, His Word for wisdom, His Spirit for power, His people for endurance. And children, since you want to have a good life, and since that good life is found in relationship with God, then do what will make that possible. Don't be a fool. You can go get what you think you want, and it will not be what you want if it's not what God wants. And parents, since you do love your children, and most parents do, then you want them to have a good life, right? Well, then help make that possible. Figure out how to apply the gospel in real-life situations. This is difficult. But the foundation is, you have to start with, not what do I do, but what's the foundation? The foundation, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so Paul wrote in Philippians 2, don't just look to your own needs, but also look to the needs of others. So children, as they honor their parents, bring joy to their parents, they're also going to maximize their own joy. Parents, as they love their children, by training them, not exasperating them, exasperate kids by being mean, moody, demanding, unreasonable, then they experience joy, and guess what? That brings joy to the children. And what Paul said earlier in this book about forgiving one another, it certainly applies to parents. I asked my kids to forgive me a lot. I made a lot of mistakes, and they forgave me. And we actually like each other a lot now that they're adults. In verses 5 to 9, he addresses a very common and complex relationship in the first century, slaves and masters. And again, we're going to look at this when we get to Philemon. But in McLaughlin's book, where she has a chapter on slavery in the Bible, she references the work of OU Provost and Professor of History Kyle Harper. And Kyle is an expert on the impact of Christianity on the rise of human dignity and its impact particularly on slavery. And human rights were not, as is commonly believed, the result of the Enlightenment of the 18th century, but the idea that all people have equal dignity has its historical roots in Christianity. Slavery was very complex in the first century, and slavery was ubiquitous. It was everywhere in the world in the first century. And there were literally a couple of million slaves in the Roman Empire, and they included prisoners of war, debtors paying off financial debt rather than going to prison, and even household servants who were now free. They'd worked off their debt, but they chose to stay free. So let's look at this from a macro view. And in verses 5 to 9, he tells masters the same principles apply to you that apply to your servants. In verse 7, he says, serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not men, because you know the Lord will reward everyone for whatever he does, whether he is slave or free. And then he says, this applies to both of you. So imagine how revolutionary it would be in a culture where slaves were property to tell masters to serve their servants. In fact, all the way back in Exodus, when the law was given to Moses at Sinai, there was a law that slave catching, going out and enslaving people, was a capital offense. This was revolutionary a long time ago. Historically, the Christian worldview formed the basis that led to the end of slavery. And you can say, well, what about this Christian in history who held slaves, this Christian who held slaves? Well, they were wrong, obviously. But it was Christians who led the charge, starting in the very early centuries, to end slavery. More on that in June. So Paul's given this young church the truth and the power of the gospel that are able to shape our thinking, our values, and our behaviors in ways that lead to freedom and beauty in relationships. He's given a wide range of examples of how this works out in interpersonal relationships. And he's going to finish with this realistic and very sober challenge, and it's a challenge that in itself indicates that none of this is going to be easy. We didn't really think it was, but he's going to make sure we don't think it is. So Peter, who was the Lord's early on fickle but later on squared away friend, was very frank about our tendency to be dismayed when the life of faith is hard. He said in his book, 1 Peter 4:6, don't be surprised at the painful trial you're suffering as if something strange were happening to you, which means they were surprised. This is tough. What's going on here? I mean, we're doing it right here, Pete. We're trusting God, praying, going to church, living a moral life, and we're having some terrible problems. Is God messing up or are we messing up? And Peter said, don't be surprised. This is not strange. This is the way it's going to be. And Paul knows this is how the human mind commonly goes when things get hard. Okay, Paul, I got it. You gave me a list in these chapters to the church at Ephesus. I got it. I made my list. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. I'm not doing that. Now everything's going to go okay for me, right? No, it's not a checklist. So he's going to roll up his sleeves and he's going to land this thing and he's going to say, here's the gospel truth and the gospel power of God. It's going to shape our hearts, minds, lives, and leads to increasing beauty and freedom. But the gospel life is lived in a war zone. So we call our men's rally, we used to call it men's rally, battle staff. And when I first said that, I didn't even think about video games and these, you know, you shall not pass, you know, these battle staffs. I wasn't thinking about battle staff. In a deployed location, when the leaders come together to discuss the war situation, those people coming together is the staff, and that meeting is called battle staff. So no, not some big Gandalf stick. This is men coming together to discuss living in this battle zone. So when I say war zone, just like when I say battle staff, different images emerge in different minds. Some people maybe Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers, or video games, or Terrible Home Life. For me, when I think of a war zone, I think of a base in Iraq where we worked out, we ate food, we had church services, we did normal stuff. We watched movies, and we had mortars coming over the wall on a regular basis, and we were not home. And there were foreign nationals that were on base under armed guard because you didn't know for sure if they were friend or foe. Soldiers would come into the dining hall and they put their guns over their chairs before they ate. There were reminders everywhere that we were in a war zone. And so when we first got to Iraq, when the sirens went off signaling an attack, I would overreact because it was unique for me. over time, we learned to underreact. So one time we were out playing basketball on an outdoor court, and in a mild dust storm, you could still sort of see. And the defensive weapons fired, alarms went off. You could see the boom in the sky. And we stopped, thought, and then we kept playing basketball. And that's a really bad idea. You shouldn't do that. And so when I think of Paul's war zone analogy, I think you have to live in regular life, but to live in a state of constant readiness. You can't overreact, but you certainly can't underreact. And keeping that tension is tough because we tend to either go to fear and anger or passivity and apathy. It's really hard to live with faith and love and in a state of spiritual readiness. At least it's hard for me. So when I get into this state of readiness mode, then I start looking mad. And my wife will say, "You look mad," you know. So I was like, okay, so don't look mad, and then okay, but stay in a place of readiness. It's really hard to do. That's why we have to walk in the Spirit to do it. So when I've read of people talking about the Christian life as a battle, the application is sometimes, well, it's a battle. You can't live a normal life. You're in a war zone. Yeah, but even in war zones, people live a sort of normal. They still wash clothes. They still exercise. They watch movies. When you're on the front, yeah, but people don't live on the front the whole time, even in a war zone. Or be afraid. The enemy's going to get you. That's what it means. Well, be ready, but living in fear is not healthy and it's not sustainable. Well, then be angry. You're in a war zone. You should be angry and combative. You should be ready to fight everyone about everything, including other Christians. There's too much at stake. Well, be ready, but don't be a jerk. Don't treat everyone as an enemy. And even if they are enemy, you're supposed to love them. So Paul's analogy of living prepared for battle doesn't mean we're to throw away everything else he's already said about this life of faith, which is love and joy and hope and confidence. It's about an attitude of readiness, not about becoming this combative person. Another thing about this passage I've noticed is it can be made into something weird and totally out of touch with everyday life, kind of overly spiritualized. But it's not. It's practical. It's a summary using a military analogy of what he's said in his letters so far. Here's the truth of the gospel. Here's the love of God that we embrace in our hearts. Here's how it works out in everyday life. So finally, live in a state of readiness. Live with hope and joy and love and confidence, but live ready. You're not home. You're in a spiritual war zone. So be strong in the Lord and in His mighty power. And maybe as Paul is finishing up this letter, I don't know if it's taking him days, weeks, months. He's on house arrest in Rome. Maybe he's thinking about, how do I drive this home? How do I make sure they know, you know, this is tough? So maybe he looked out the door and there's a Roman soldier who's going to be there every day standing guarding Paul, the prisoner. You know, you might see someone in a restaurant in Wichita wearing a military uniform, but they don't have battle gear on. They don't have a weapon. They don't have body armor. They don't have helmets. Hopefully that doesn't ever happen here. But in Rome, first century Rome, and in countries around the world, you would see battle-ready soldiers everywhere. And we're used to living far from battlefields. We send military members over there so they don't have to fight over here. And 2 weeks ago or three, I spoke with a Kansas soldier who was in the States, but he lives and works in the U.S. Embassy in Armenia. Most people in America don't know that last year Armenia was at war with its neighbor Azerbaijan, and thousands of Armenians were killed and injured out of a small population, about 3 million people. Very traumatic. But you think about the capital of Armenia is about to the capital of Azerbaijan, is about from here to Oklahoma City. So think about combat in that situation. The battle wasn't way over there. And so the spiritual battle for us, Paul's saying, it's not over there somewhere. It's everywhere you go. It's in the car when you're all by yourself. It's going on in here. And again, we want to keep the tension. Don't live in fear. Don't withdraw from everyday life. Don't become combative. Live with faith, hope, and love in a state of readiness. And the way the news cycle works, the way the news cycle prospers, is by making people feel emotions. And the two big emotions that drive Americans are anger and fear. And so fear and anger both require an enemy. You got to have someone to be afraid of and someone to be mad at. And so news helps create enemies. But the gospel doesn't engage our hearts that way. It drives us by the engines of faith and love, which are the opposites of fear and anger. And so Paul's saying, you do have an enemy. It just doesn't happen to be one another. There's a spiritual enemy. So with faith and love, we're to live with our eyes open to the reality of the battle around us, to be prepared to be strong in the Lord and in His mighty power. And so this is no game. We're not playing at this. Yeah, we're sitting in a chair in a building on Sunday morning, but this is for real. This is for real. Life in community in small groups has very high stakes. What we believe shapes what we love, shapes who we become. The stakes are not any higher anywhere else. So we want to live ready, joyful, faithful, hopeful, and ready. So, verse 11, put on the full armor of God so that when you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. And the key word in this passage, and he says it over and over, is stand. Plant yourself firmly in a place and don't let yourself be moved from there. Now here's what that doesn't mean. Be a hard head on every political, social issue. It's not what it means. It's take a stand regarding the gospel. Don't be a hard head in the rest of your life, but take a stand on the gospel. Michael Walsh has written a book entitled Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. It's interesting. I'm not recommending it. It's not a Christian book, but it is a fascinating book. And so from a human standpoint, Paul did take a last stand on the gospel. He would be killed by Rome. But it was not a last stand in his mind. In his mind, hope is never lost. All is never lost when you take a stand on the gospel. So look at verses 12 to 16. He's going to talk about this battle, and he's going to describe it in terms of a soldier putting on their armor. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against authorities, against the powers of the dark world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. That sounds very weird, esoteric, but it's for real. So what you see around you is a result of what's going on in a real spiritual war. Therefore, since that's true, put on the full armor of God so when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. And after you've done everything to stand, stand firm then, with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, with the breastplate of righteousness in place, with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all that, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one, and then take the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. So the points he's making using this military analogy are, don't underestimate your enemy. Don't mistake who your enemy really is. Do live in a state of constant readiness by living in what he's been talking about, living in union with Christ, staying plugged into the Spirit. And he describes this as putting on the armor of God. This is all analogous to this whole life of living connected to Jesus. Start with the truth of God. And he talks about the belt. And the belt was a girdle of sorts. It was what they would wear under their armor to keep their robe tied up so they could move freely about. That's the truth of God. It's underneath everything. Righteousness is our body armor. It's righteousness here, he's not talking about becoming saved, which is becoming the righteousness of God. He's talking about rightness of God, that in our hearts the Word is shaping us and we're becoming people who more and more live the truth. Our battle boots are the readiness of the gospel. The truth of the gospel, the reality of peace with God is where we take our stand. Then there's a shield which covers most of a soldier's body. This is a shield of faith. And faith just means reliance on God. So sometimes people go, I'm going to put on the armor of God. I now take up the shield of faith. Like it's an incantation. It's not an incantation. It's a reality. The shield, if you want to take up the shield of faith, then rely on God right now. So the application of that would be, I take up the shield of faith. No, it would be, okay, I'm really ticked off at my boss. I'm going to trust God with this situation, and this is where I'm going to stand. I mean, the application is enormously practical. And then the Romans had a system whereby they would lock a lot of these large, these were big shields. They weren't little things like this. They would lock them together for corporate defense in battle. You've probably seen that in movies, you know, and there's this whole big defense together. And last week we looked at Ephesians 4:9, which I said was speaking words that reframe the conversation to include the reality of God. And so we lock shields together as we live in community day by day, reminding one another the truth of God. And then the helmet of salvation. Our salvation is our final deliverance. Our future hope is secure. Why do we fight? Because all is never lost for us. And then the Spirit uses the Word of God as a defensive and offensive weapon. And then in verse 18, he says, and pray in the Spirit on all kinds of occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert. That's that state of readiness, and always keep on praying for all the saints. So when he says pray in the Spirit, it's not like, okay, there's regular praying, Terry praying, and then praying in the Spirit praying. He's talking about prayer. Praying in the Spirit is praying. It's how you're supposed to pray. You're supposed to live connected to the Spirit. We're supposed to move through life talking to God as we go. And the difference between prayers and requests, it could be repetition for emphasis, which he does sometimes. But prayers is a generic word for thanks and praise and questions and all these everyday conversations with God. And then and prayer ought to be a conversation with God. One of my favorite prayers I've ever heard was when Crystal, our oldest, was a little girl. I forgot how old she was, 3 maybe, 4. She's in her room. I walked by one night and she was talking to God. She was little bitty. And she said, God, thank you for everything. You made everything. And then she said, even space aliens. And then I stopped, and then I realized she probably just got scared. She goes, but they're not real. So she goes, maybe I don't want to think about space aliens right now. But she was just having this really cool conversation with God. That's the prayers. And then requests is a word that means to ask for specific things. And we're to move through life connected to God, talking to God about ourselves and others. And then Paul personalizes this. Verse 19, pray for me also, that whenever I open my mouth, words may be given me, so I will fearlessly make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I'm an ambassador in chains. And that was not a metaphor. He was in chains. And then pray I would declare it fearlessly as I should. So he's God's ambassador to Rome, but he's not living in an embassy. He's on house arrest. And twice here he asks that they would pray for him so he would speak the truth of the gospel fearlessly. Now, Paul's not playing games with them. He's not like, you know, I'm good to go, but I'm telling him all this stuff. Maybe I should just throw out a prayer request. I pray that I would be fearless. He's saying this because this was a challenge for him. It's hard. Being a husband or wife, trying to figure out how to honor Christ in those roles is hard. Being a parent or a child is hard. Being a master or servant is hard. Living the gospel, speaking the gospel fearlessly is hard. Living in a highly sexualized culture, living in an idol worshiping culture like they did, like we do, is hard. Living in a highly contentious, divided culture like they did, like we do, is hard. It's tough. And so why try? Why try? Well, because it's true. Because it's real. And if you consider this life of living in a state of readiness and you start to think, you know, why in the world push so hard? I mean, you're in high school, middle school, college. Why in the world put up with this? Other people aren't putting up with it. Why give effort to living in line with faith? Why have to keep forgiving people and trying to love God and others and give the effort? Why not just do what my friends are doing? Why not just do what I want? You can. So, as if you needed it, you have permission. You can go do that if you want. But just don't be fooled. So, you're not going to ever trade hard for easy. This is not going to happen. You can choose whether you want to spend your life or waste your life, but you're not going to save your life. Nobody is. And you can decide, do I want hard good or hard bad? You can make that decision. You can say, I want hard real or hard not real, or I want hard with hope or hard with no hope. You can make those decisions. But you can't say, can I have C, not hard? No, you can't. You're not going to get it. But you can have hard real, hard good, and hard with hope. And so Paul wrote, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. So don't think you're going to find an easier or better way. You won't find a better way. This is a better way. Be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. So let's pray together. Talk to God. Pretend like you're Crystal, just talking to him. Space aliens, whatever. Just talk to him. And talk to him, say, God, this is hard, or this is good, or I have questions. Talk to him and listen to him.